Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
School violence comes in many forms. You no doubt realize that it is an issue of great concern to parents, teachers, and school officials, not to mention the students themselves. It might be your future employees that school climate influences, or even future crime rates. You've felt deeply about the bereaved parents you hear about on the news, whether they lost their child to armed attacks on schools or to suicide after prolonged and heartless cyber attacks through texting or social networks. Dr. Elizabeth Englander is back with us today, this time to share ways that parents or guardians and school officials can work cooperatively to cultivate a positive atmosphere and deal with problems when they arise. But first, I'd like to welcome you to the Social Network Show. I'm your host, Dr. J, along with co-host Jim Nico. And today we will welcome back Dr. Elizabeth Englander, the founder and director of the Massachusetts Aggression Reduction Center, MARC, and the psychology professor at Bridgewater State University. So we want to know from you, if we might ask you, Dr. Englander, what, first of all, you know, I avoided the term bullying and cyberbullying, and there's a reason why. Can you tell us what it is about those terms that you think is maybe counterproductive at this point?
Well, I think both of them are probably being overused. I think that's definitely a problem, actually. And so one of the things that we found in research is that teenagers tend to overuse the term twice for each time that they're really using it accurately. So we have a situation where people, I think, are using the word bullying particularly to refer to any time when somebody is mean to them or hurts their feelings, anytime at all. Cyberbullying is a little problematic too. I think it does get overused, but also there's a lot of problems that can happen online between people that are really not bullying per se, but they're still pretty serious. And so we're probably calling too many types of cyber problems cyber bullying per se.
Well, there's one researcher who promotes the term peer victimization in school contexts. Is that a little bit better?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit better just because it's it might make users think a little bit about what are we talking about, you know? And I think what's tricky for people is I think it's really hard sometimes to pull apart the problems that happen that are more typical or just normal that are going to happen to everybody in life that don't really indicate a serious problem, versus the kinds of social interactions that really are more serious. And I think it can be very tricky to pull those apart.
Well, that is part of the reason why I think some people feel bullying minimizes the problem, because it's has been taken as you say, a normal part of life and so on. I mean, even as adults, we know that and this is a problem that affects many adults, too, as far as that goes, which is another reason for using terms like cyber abuse or harassment or even sometimes cyber assault, depending on, you know, just the broad spectrum, you know, how widespread is an attack on someone online. But the problem of minimizing it in terms of just the normal, natural things that go on. But I like the fact that you point out it, and have done so in our previous programs, that it isn't really we should take the focus off determining whether something is or is not bullying when it occurs in the school environment. And what we want to know is it a positive social behavior. And I remember you talked to us about a 9-second response in the past. Could you just briefly review that for us?
Sure. That has to do with how do you build an environment where kids and adults see being cruel to somebody as not normal, as not okay. And that may sound really obvious, but what's tricky about it is that kids can learn that different environments call for different kinds of behavior. And a lot of the times the kids that I study, when they come into the lab, they may tell us that they know that there's certain things they can't do at home. So they can't, for example, be openly contemptuous of their parents at home. They can't roll their eyes when their parents talk to them. They understand that at home they're not supposed to do that, and that in that environment those kinds of behaviors are not tolerated. But then they go to school and they may find something very different. They may feel like that's an environment where if you sort of look snarky or contemptuous, you're going to actually be seen as a little more cool and a little more, a little more confident than somebody who is more polite. So the 9-second response is about an attempt to teach kids about what do we expect from them in terms of their social behavior in school. And it essentially focuses simply on letting kids know that what they're doing is not okay. It doesn't really matter what the response is of the target. So if you see a child who's doing something very contemptuous towards another child, like, for example, they are ignoring them when they talk, or they're whispering about them right in front of them, obviously whispering about them, then these are the kinds of things that really kind of poison the atmosphere in a school. Uh-huh. So what we can do as adults is say to them, this is not okay. Don't do it. It really bothers her to stop. And it's really a matter of taking on the responsibility to say to kids, this is what it's appropriate to do socially, and this is what it's not appropriate. And when you are not appropriate socially, that impacts everybody.
Exactly. And you pointed out that when we do this, we can put it on our own values or estimation of it. In other words, we don't have to say, how do you think Johnny feels when you do that? Trying to appeal to empathy, that is not a helpful thing to do.
That's right. They usually know how it makes the other child feel.
Which is probably why they're doing it.
So they usually know, it's really not something that's a mystery to them.
Right. And, you bring up an interesting point, too, that is in something else you discuss in your book, Bullying and Cyberbullying, What Every Educator Needs to Know. And that is that an audience is really part and parcel of this type of behavior, taunting someone, being cruel to them. And how does that work? Why is it so important for there to be bystanders?
Well, because you really can't defeat this kind. The only way to control this kind of social behavior is to have the whole community or society control it. So it doesn't work very well to say to kids things like, you should always be nice to people because you should. Because they may think to themselves, well, but when I'm not so nice, other people think I'm kind of cool. And that's a pretty strong argument against what you're saying. If you focus on the costs or the benefits to them individually, there's always going to be sort of another point of view that they can pull in. But when it's the idea is that when it's everybody you're impacting, there's sort of no way to fight City Hall. So if everybody is saying, listen, you're not just impacting targets, you're impacting all of us. That's far too powerful a statement. And that's why we exert social control on behavior in the first place. And it's by far the most effective way to change social behaviors.
is to, can you rephrase that just again?
Sure. It's far more effective to use, to say to people, what you're doing is impacting your entire community or the society of people in this school or the community of people in this school or your entire family. Impacting a broad group of people is not something anybody's going to feel comfortable about just doing and not caring about. It's really what they're comfortable with is when they target an individual, but everybody else seems to approve. That makes them feel comfortable, and that makes them feel like they can continue the behavior. They're getting something out of it. They're getting a positive out of it. But if people say to them, you know, you're not getting everybody else's approval, in fact, we disapprove of what you're doing, then it becomes far more powerful as a shaper of their behavior.
Let's go into the whole idea of the bystander and what they can do in the next segment, because I think that's a real important part of this whole equation.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
This moment of uncontrollable laughter was made possible by a 32-year-old man with little to no coordination attempting to execute a simple cartwheel. His name is Sergeant Warner, but young James, our laughing friend here, simply calls him Dad. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show, and we are talking with Dr. Elizabeth Englander of Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts. While we were on break, we were discussing that 9-second response and that just simply telling someone at a significant time that what they are doing or saying is not appropriate and not acceptable. But Jim, you had a question on that.
Yeah. So say I'm a parent and I want to, like, for example, I heard one of your shows, Dr. Englander, and I'm very impressed with it. And you mentioned the 9-second rule or what can be done in 9 seconds. So if you can embellish on that, let's just say I'm a parent, my kid's walking out the door, or I have 9 seconds and I want to address his behavior, good or bad, what can I do in 9 seconds, even if I repeat it many times, you know, like 9 seconds 50 times or something like that?
Right. I think the trick here is to be really consistent and to put your money where your mouth is. So what you need to do as a parent is say, there are certain things that I expect from you, and I expect you to be responsible and responsible in terms of behaving appropriately towards me and towards the members of our family. And how responsibly you behave and how well you behave is going to be linked to the privileges you enjoy. So, you know, when you behave appropriately, you're going to get many more privileges than if you are behaving inappropriately. And to use somewhat of the same message and to say, you can't just say, well, if I put down my little sister, that doesn't affect you. You can't make that argument, because if you put down your little sister all the time, that impacts all of us. So that makes me feel differently sitting here listening to it. It makes me feel differently about you. And it makes our house and our family feel differently. It's not okay. It's not okay.
So taking a few of those thoughts and just making sure that you have set that expectation. And, you know, I like to think of this in a sense as treading water. A lot of times you may not see a change in behavior from that, right? Whether you're a teacher in school or whether you're a parent rearing your children. But you've brought out also, Dr. Englander, about how setting those expectations do make a difference to the kids, even if they seem to be ignoring them.
That's right. I mean, over the long term, they shouldn't be ignoring them. But certainly, I wouldn't expect to see any dramatic changes fast. I mean, the first thing that happens when a child hears this kind of input is they think, okay, are they serious or are they just feeling cranky right now? And that's the first thing they're going to test. Do you really mean it when you say you expect something, or are there exceptions to that rule? And so if I'm the child, I'm going to test those waters out. I'll try doing it again in front of you. I'll try doing it in different places. I'll try doing it in slightly different ways and see if this is something that's really going to stick. Once I get the feeling that you're serious about what you're saying and you mean it, then I'll start changing my behavior.
When we talk about it in terms of social networks and texting on the cell phone and such as that, how much mm-hmm. of inappropriate behavior do you think parents actually know about?
Well, I don't think they know about much, but I'm not sure how much they know about in person either. I think that kids have a lot of interactions that don't happen, in front of adults. And that's just, that is part of growing up. And, that sort of portion of their life where they have to kind of self-police. The values that you emphasize to them, bleed down into that area. So if you emphasize to your kids that you should treat people well because that's the right thing to do, then if they're online and they're thinking about making a snarky comment to somebody, they do it, it's going to feel really different than if they think their parents don't care about it.
You know, we talked about, we're just getting into the question of bystanders and how they influence mm-hmm. Negative behavior. And there can be bystanders on in terms of texting or sending photos in school, on social networks, certainly, since a lot of them are, all listening or checking in at various times. Mm-hmm. What do we need to stress with people, whether they're young people or, again, this applies to adults online, as far as bystanders? When we see something or witness something, what does that do for the whole situation, and what alternatives do we have?
I actually think it's trickier online, because a lot of times if somebody is being mean to another person, then other people may know about it, but they may not witness it when it happens. It may only be after the fact that they know about it, after right. It's already happened. Uh-huh. And so that sort of eliminates some of the possibilities. The other thing is that it's sometimes hard to know when you're misreading a situation online. So it wouldn't be workable to have a situation where every time somebody saw something that was a little bit, that looked a little bit mean, they sort of jumped up and attacked it. It's like that wouldn't work, because sometimes people are kidding around between themselves, and you sort of mm-hmm. don't know about it. Mm-hmm. It can be very difficult to read these kind of subtle signals in digital environments. But there's some things that kids can always do. And so, for example, people can always approach somebody later and say, did that make you feel uncomfortable? Because it made me feel uncomfortable watching how he was talking to you. Is everything okay? Are you having a problem with it or with this person? There's something wrong with checking in with somebody and seeing how they're feeling. And I think that's something people can can definitely always do without worrying about the impact. But a lot of times it's tricky to encourage bystanders to jump in the middle of something because it's very, very hard to do that. And they might do it and be wrong, or if they know, you know, if they feel like they're supposed to always jump in the middle, then, you know, sometimes it's easier just to conclude that this isn't a problem, or it's not a case that needs that kind of intervention, or the victim deserves what's happening, you know, and so it's justified, that kind of thing.
Well, you mentioned the in face-to-face situations, the value of leaving, just ceasing to be a spectator. And if it's severe to the point of, you know, where it needs to be reported, to do so if possible. I know that's very, you know, problematic and iffy, but at least leaving. Now, how does that work?
Well, people generally speaking want an audience. And so sometimes not just refusing to be the audience is the best way to deal with these things. Not always, but sometimes it really is. And so that's one of the options, particularly among kids. Maybe, you know, it's a little tougher to call this with adults, but particularly with kids, that can sometimes be helpful. Other things kids can do rather than jumping into the middle is doing things like trying to say something nice to a target later on, you know, telling targets things like, you know, don't pay any attention to when they were talking to you, because that person gets really cranky and they say things like that to a lot of people, and just ignore them. Saying anything, even the most simple thing, can really, really help targets a lot. And I think it's better to encourage that rather than to encourage kids to do things that are very high risk and that they're much less likely to do.
Well, when this happens in the school environment, even if it's online, sometimes the school is aware of it going on, how can parents help their children's school in its prevention efforts? I mean, there is sometimes a tension between school officials and parents. How can that be diffused?
I think there's definitely sometimes a tension. There are a couple of things that parents can do. One thing they can do is provide information. And you'd be surprised how often a parent will say to me something like, well, my kid and this other kid have had problems since third grade. And now it's, you know, eighth grade. And they're still picking on my child. And I went to the principal and I said, this is going on. And I don't know what they're doing, but maybe they're doing nothing. If you say to them, well, did you tell them about the history? They'll often say to me, no, I assume they know that. So the first rule, I think, about helping schools resolve these issues is never assume that schools know anything. They may not know. They may not know the history. It doesn't always follow children from building to building. Mm-hmm. And don't assume that they have all the information you have. So make sure that you get really good quality information from your child, like exactly what's going on, where is it happening, who else is present, how often does it happen. You know, walk me through it. You walk in, they walk in. What happens next? That kind of thing. Like, all of those details are how a school is going to be much better at resolving it. So that's always the number one thing I say to parents is be sure to get really good information and be sure that the school has that information.
The other thing you often hear is that a parent of the perpetrator is in denial. So what is denial just one thing, or how do you interpret that?
It's not just one thing. There's a couple of different kinds of denial and different sources. And I go over that a little bit in the book. The first thing I always say to people is, look, you know, let's throw parents a bone here. This is not an easy thing to deal with. And if your child has these kinds of behavior problems, it can be very hard to know what to do. Let's not attack people. Let's try to help parents help their children. And if parents are in denial, the first thing I would say is if you're the parent of the target, is don't approach them yourself. Go ahead and work through the school, because it can really set up a dynamic where you're sort of against each other, and it can really make the whole situation much worse. I will tell you, I've run across a number of situations where there was a bullying problem happening between two children, and both sets of parents got involved. And, you know, you go a few months down the road, the kids have figured it out, they've made up, they've forgotten about it, they've moved on, and the parents are still in World War III with each other. So you don't want to go there. You know, you really don't want to go there. I think that we have to manage our expectations for schools. Remember that schools can't talk to you about what they do to other kids. So don't expect to hear it. If your child is being victimized, you can't go into the school and say, I want to know what you did to that kid. You can't say that. The school can't tell you, and you shouldn't expect to hear it. It's frustrating. You want to know. Everybody wants to know, but you're not going to know. And it may look like nothing's being done, but that doesn't mean nothing's being done, because you're not going to be told. You're not going to be privy to that information.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so also, I also do think in terms of managing your expectations, it's important to remember that schools and adults in general, yourself included as a parent, you can't always fix these problems for children.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always possible.
Well, that I think managing expectations is a good way of putting it, and something that's going to help all parties involved to do their best, but realize that, you know, that may not make everything okay, especially in quick order. We thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Englander, and your book, Bullying and Cyberbullying, What Every Educator Needs to Know, I think will be a tremendous help in working with parents and schools to manage the school climate and environment. So we hope that you'll join us again on the Social Network Show. We're looking forward to talking with Dr. Englander again. And please watch for us on Stitcher.com, The Social Network Show. And we are also on iTunes and at our website, of course, TheSocialNetworkStation.com. And check out the blog. Thank you very much, Dr. Englander, for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.